Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you on Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ or online at kmjnow.com. Quick programming note, next week the Bulldog football game is a little earlier. Remember, we've got Bulldog football tonight at 7:15 against New Mexico State. Next week the game is earlier, so there will be no Hometown Heroes. 1 week from today, we will return the following week. And today we're going to take you up in the air and all over the place with Bob Stoneham, a B-26 pilot from World War II, makes his home in Mariposa now. Bob, thanks so much for being with me today, and I understand you've got some decent stories you've told a time or two in your life.
Well, I don't know whether they're decent or not, but at least they're clean.
They're not indecent.
No, they're not indecent, and you know, I have one problem with your program.
The title?
Yeah, the title. We don't consider ourselves heroes. We were there because it was a job to do.
And you're going to tell me that the real heroes are the ones that didn't come home, right?
That's exactly right. Plus some of those that stayed at home, like my wife that stayed home and folded bandages at the Red Cross and things like that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that one of the things that I'm continually amazed by, no matter who I talk to, was the unity that existed in this country and how everybody, no matter if they're overseas or here at home, no matter what they were doing, they all understood the importance, the significance of what was happening and pitched in together. And I have had several veterans mention that they don't consider themselves heroes. The reason I call the show Hometown Heroes, it's the idea that no matter where you live in our country, no matter what your hometown is, you can look around to your neighbors and see someone who, like you, did what you were asked to do in World War II. And I think that is something that we in our generation can look at and be inspired by and aspire to. So that's why I call it Hometown Heroes. So you don't have to call yourself a hero. But I'm going to try if you're going to let me get away with it. And let's start, Bob, if we can, as I do with so many veterans. December 7th, 1941, the day that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, a Sunday morning. And everybody has a different story about how they heard about those events. What's your story? Where were you and how'd you find out?
Very vivid, as though it was yesterday. I was coming down the steps of the First Christian Church in Modesto at the end of the church service. And there were a group of fellows gathered around a car out there where someone had turned on a car radio and announced that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor.
I'm sure you'd never heard of Pearl Harbor before.
That's about right.
did it register, wow, this is an incredible deal, this is going to change the world?
No, actually, for a year or two before that, we were rather nervously going to school because things were happening in Europe and we weren't involved in, but we thought we might. And, of course, when this happened on December 7th, we were pretty sure we were going to be involved. But I was only 17, so it was nothing that I was going to do at that moment.
Had to finish up high school first.
I was still in junior college at that time.
Yeah, you already? Okay. And when did you decide, you know what, I'm going to end up in the Air Corps? This is what I want to do. I've heard a lot of guys say they want to be a pilot. A lot of them don't end up being pilots. You actually did. But how did that progression ensue?
Through high school, I was in the vocational aeronautics class, always interested in airplanes. In that class, we were building them. We weren't flying them.
Was it all the crop dusters you saw around the valley that got you going?
I was raised on a farm between Modesto and Ceres.
Uh-huh.
But when I turned 18, I decided that I would like to get into aviation cadet training. Got some recommendations from the people that I needed. Went to the Stockton Air Base to sign up. Flunked the physical.
Mm.
I had a hernia that I had had for years, and it really hadn't bothered me a lot. In fact, in junior college, I was on the boxing team, and it didn't bother me then. But it stopped me from getting into the Air Force. So I went home, and my father was a Spanish-American War veteran.
Mm.
And he said, if you really want to do this, I'll pay for the surgery to have it done.
Wow.
So in July of, 42, after I turned 18, I went in and had the surgery done and went back that fall and was enlisted on December 15th, 1942.
So that's how badly you wanted to do what you ended up doing. You were willing to go under the knife. And how much of that was tied into hearing your father's stories about his service? Was that a motivation for you?
Not really. At that point, it was just the thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Had he ever told you many stories? Was that something that kind of fascinated you, his experience?
No, not really. My father was considerably older than I. He was 45 when I was born.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I was here, he was in his 60s. And And we didn't talk much. He didn't talk about his service hardly at all.
Well, I'm glad that you're here talking about yours today. So with that persistence paying off, you end up in the U.S. Army Air Corps, and they make you pilot overnight, right? You don't have to train or anything.
Just like that. No, actually, when after December 15th, they sent us home to wait for a call, and which came about the 1st of February of 43, and I was shipped off to Lincoln, Nebraska for basic training. There we learned which were left feet and which were right feet, and that was about all. It was
they didn't teach
weather.
You that at Modesto High School, I guess.
No.
Sorry,
it was freezing
Panthers.
Weather, and we had about a month of basic training of learning how to march was what we were doing. Then from there I went to Cedar Rapids, Iowa for a co-college for a college detachment. From there to Santa Ana Army Air Base, pre-flight training. That was in the summer of, 43? The hernia recurred, and I had to have surgery again at that time. But then after pre-flight, I went through the flying school in primary in Phoenix, Arizona, flying Stearmans. Basic was in BT-13s in Lancaster, California. And then advanced was twin-engine advanced at Douglas, Arizona, in really hot little twin-engine airplanes.
You know, now most pilots that I've interviewed, whether they ended up flying fighters or bombers or something in between, a lot of them wanted to be fighter pilots. And I haven't heard too many guys that say, I want to go fly the biggest plane I can fly. What was your bent at the time?
No, the dream was to fly P-38s. If we were twin engine, we wanted to fly fighter planes. Why, I don't know, but that was just what everybody wanted to do. However, when we got to Douglas, the colonel that greeted us said, gentlemen, not all of you are going to make it through here because we got pilots running out of our ears. So we had to really apply ourselves. From the time we started in flight training in aviation cadets at that time, only about 50% got all the way through. The washout rate was about 50-50.
And a lot of, I'm sure, as you ended up being deployed eventually, a lot of the guys that you served with on your crews are probably guys that initially went in as pilots, washed out, ended up as bombardiers or gunners or navigators.
Yes, that's correct.
Ever sense any resentment there that you were one of the ones that got through and they weren't?
No.
You guys had to be a team no matter
what. That's exactly right.
So this is a pretty long process. From the time that you go into the service wanting to be a pilot, you had to wait quite a while before you actually got to do what you went in to do.
When we graduated on May the 23rd, 1944, class of 44E, went home on 10 days leave, and my orders were to return to Douglas as a twin-engine advanced instructor, which was kind of a different idea. I had never thought of anything like that. While home on leave, however, I received a telegram from the War Department saying, return to Douglas, Arizona, prepare for immediate overseas duty, cold, wet, windy climate. So I know we weren't going to the South Pacific.
I guess not. And what were your emotions tied into that? I imagine if you invest all this time, all this chunk of your life in wanting to go fly a plane in combat, when they tell you you're going to be stateside as an instructor, you're probably a little disappointed. Or were there some mixed emotions?
At that point, I can't answer that. We were so pleased to get through with our flight training, and I hadn't thought too much about being an instructor, and I didn't have much time to, obviously, because I got the wire that changed that.
So then it's, okay, here we go. Finally, this is about to start, and no more waiting around. This is business now.
Yeah, it was about 80 of us, and they put us on a train to, first we went to North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina, for our overseas shots and familiarization with what we were supposed to meet when we got in England. Remember now, you're going over there as guests of those people, and they prayed it on pretty heavy for us at that time. But anyway, we got our preparation there, and then we went up to New Jersey, Camp Kilmer, for the final overseas stuff. Shipped out on His Majesty's transport to Scythia on July the 1st, 1944.
Did you know what plane you were going to fly yet at that
Absolutely
point?
Not. Had no idea.
So you don't know what you're going to be...
Had no idea.
That had to be at least a little bit unsettling for you.
Yeah, probably, but here you're dealing with a bunch of kids. I mean, here I am. I'm not old enough to vote or have a really beer that I could buy over the counter.
Mm-hmm.
We were young people, and it was just an experience.
And when, just for our audience's sake, when I say he doesn't know what plane he's going to fly, I don't mean which B-26. I mean, he doesn't know if he's flying a B-26, a B-24, a B-17. It's going
to
be...
That's right. We didn't know until we got to Liverpool, England, what groups we were going to go to.
So that there's some suspense, I guess, tied into that. A little bit of anticipation as you took that long trip across the Atlantic.
2 weeks, 60-ship...
Convoy?
Convoy going across, right.
Now, what's going through your mind during all that time?
Not much.
Yeah?
There were card games and what have you.
I won't ask you who won. That's a good place for us to take our first break, but when we come back, we'll hear about Bob's first mission in a B-26. We'll hear about all his missions about B-26. Maybe talk about the B-26 in general, too, and some of the nicknames that it earned and how that played into his mindset as he served our United States Army Air Corps in World War II. Bob Stoneham of Mariposa, our guest today. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes on Newstalk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Thinking you remember that song Sentimental Journey. Maybe it puts you in a sentimental mood. Bob and Betty Stoneham remember that tune from way back when, and I hope you do too. Bob Stoneham, a B-26 pilot from World War II, is our guest today. Bob and Betty have been married for 63 years, is that right?
Correct. 63 wonderful years.
Well, there you go. I'm glad it's not 62 wonderful and one not so wonderful. 63 wonderful years. We might get more about that story later on, but let's continue where we left off. Bob, who grew up in Modesto, now makes his home in Mariposa, but in 1944, he headed across the pond to Europe, didn't know what kind of plane he was going to be flying once he got there. Now, which bomb group were you with?
344th Bomb Group. Actually, I mentioned earlier that there were about 80 of us that went right out of flying school. Most of them went to two completely different groups, but I went to the 344th, and I was the only one in the group that went there. The reason I found out later was that the co-pilot for the squadron operations officer had been killed, and apparently I was sent as a replacement into his plane.
So I'm trying to put myself in your shoes here. First of all, everything you had to go through just to get overseas and actually fly, then you go there not knowing what you're going to fly. Then once you get there, all the guys that you knew through this whole process go somewhere else, and you're off on your own with people you've never met before. Bother you at all?
I don't believe that it did. I mean, frankly, it was something we were just told to do and mm-hmm. something we did.
Nothing you could do about
first,
it.
First job I ever had there was censoring mail. It was being sent home.
So you got out your scissors?
Yeah, we had to clip it.
And what, now you brought that up. I'm intrigued by that. And I've talked to so many veterans who were sending letters back and forth to sweethearts during this time. And I've heard so many stories about getting letters with Swiss cheese holes cut out of them. What was the threshold for you? What made you decide to cut something out or not cut it out?
They couldn't say where they were, mm-hmm. the location, and they could not talk about the missions, could not write about the missions that they had been on or where they'd gone.
So anything that even remotely discusses that,
right?
You got the scissors out or razor blade or what'd you use?
Razor blade, I think, yes.
Uh-huh. So how long did you have to do that?
Oh, that was just on and off for a little while, no big deal.
And when did you finally find out I'm flying a B-26 Marauder?
When we were assigned, and I met the pilot, Captain Catlin. And my first mission, however, was not with him. My first mission was just as an observer on a flight to, we were bombing, bombing ships in the harbor at across the, on the other side of the ocean, the other side of the channel.
And now, correct me if I'm wrong, had you ever been in a B-26 before that day?
before I, on the first mission. No, I'd been, yes, I had flown some familiarization around the field there is all.
But this is a pretty new thing for you to be flying that aircraft.
Brand new, right.
But I'm sure you had heard some of the nicknames that the B-26 had earned.
Yes, the flying prostitute, for example. Mm-hmm. No visible means of support.
Mm-hmm. The Widowmaker.
The Widowmaker.
The Martin
heard
Murderer.
About training in Florida, a plane a day in Tampa Bay.
Mm-hmm. That can't be very encouraging. That's not the kind of reputation an aircraft wants to carry.
It was a good airplane. Don't knock it.
Well, you're here. So that's proof enough for me, but I'm just trying to, again, put myself in your shoes. And that's not what you want to hear about the plane that you're going to be flying. But I imagine you took to it fairly quickly, got accustomed to it.
Very easy, right.
What did you like about the B-26? I know it was designed to be a little faster than the B-25, for example.
It was heavy, and it felt like it would take the whatever they threw at us, and it did. We had some of the missions, we had a lot of flak. We had a lot of holes in the airplane. Had one mission where a shell went through the wing about 6 feet from me and happened to not explode, or I would not have been here today. Went on above the plane and exploded above us. But it was a good airplane to be in, solid.
Now, those are the stories that fascinate me when you talk about close calls and how easily something could have been different. So the shell passed through?
Through the wing. When it came up, we were at about 13,000 feet, and mm-hmm. it was an aircraft from below. But the shell went through the wing. It didn't explode.
What did that sound like?
Well, I never heard it. Didn't even know what happened.
It was
the first I knew, I looked up, and our wingman was looking down, and his eyes were about as big as saucers, and he was pointing. And then we didn't know that it happened until we got on the ground.
So he saw the shell come through and explode above you?
He saw it go through, yes.
Wow. Now, those are some stories, and I'm sure there are more to come. But let's talk about your first mission. What goes through your mind when you get up in the morning, you get that briefing or whatever you're doing, and you realize, you know what, I'm going up today, people are going to be shooting at me. I know I'm going to take off in this plane, but I don't know if I'm going to land in this plane. What is that like?
You know, you're thinking more about it than we did, probably.
You just didn't have time to think.
No.
Huh?
You get up early in the morning, you have your powdered egg breakfast, and go to the briefing room. They tell you what the mission is and what to expect and what you'll find along the bomb line and so on. And it's just part of the job.
How many men on a B-26 crew?
Normally it was six, but we had seven. We carried a navigator as a lead ship.
Give you a little safety net,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, we had pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, navigator, and ours, and three gunners.
And how much time did all of you spend together outside of just while you're in the air? Were you together quite a bit on the ground?
No, not really. All of the various crew members were on the ground, but I was with fellows from other flights. But we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I was not in the same cabin or tent with my pilot or the bombardier. Well, I guess the bombardier. I had one time. I had a cabin where he was with us, but we didn't all. The crew didn't stay together necessarily.
But once you're in the air, you kind of all have to depend on each other for your very existence.
Exactly right.
How many different aircraft did you actually, I know you flew 12 combat missions in the war. How many different aircraft did you fly on those 12 missions, would
just
you say?
Just B-26s.
I mean, as far as individual planes.
Probably three or four different planes. I don't recall exactly because whatever you were assigned the day before.
Did you ever get a kick out of some of the nose art that guys would come up with?
They were exciting, yes. I think I mentioned the other day when I talked to you that I flew in 100 proof,
uh-huh.
which the captain had named. And, of course, it was interesting because when you finished your mission, you came back and landed, and the first thing that you did was you go in to be debriefed by the officers is to have a shot of booze.
Mm-hmm.
So it was common to have a little of that overseas.
So we know where the inspiration came for the title of that aircraft, 100 Proof. Did you ever get the opportunity to name any aircraft?
No.
The guys that I've talked to that did, it seemed like they felt a lot of pressure in doing that to try to get it right and not upset anybody.
They named them after their hometown or their girlfriends or wives or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Are there any from your bomb group that just really kind of cracked you up, that when you reminisce with some of your friends, you get a chuckle out of what they named those planes?
No, not really. That's a long time ago.
I've got to remember
a lot of things way back.
Well, 100 proof is good enough for me. And I know, I don't know how many of those 12 missions made you feel like hitting some 100 proof, but I know one of them was very hair-raising. I'll tell you what, we'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the landing that Bob had to make that wasn't something he had necessarily trained for. And we'll hear him share those harrowing moments with us. Bob Stoneham of Mariposa, our guest. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
I know you know that one too. Wild Blue Yonder, performed there by our local Sounds of Freedom military concert band. My guest today, Bob Stoneham, heard that a few times, as a B-26 pilot during World War II, flew 12 missions in that B-26 Martin Marauder, or as it was sometimes called, the Martin Murderer, because of the training accidents. You heard Bob talk about that earlier. One a day in Tampa Bay, the Widowmaker, the flying prostitute. Well, not that encouraging to hear those things about the aircraft he was going to be flying, but it treated him well. He is here to talk about it today. And talking about those 12 missions, Bob, I understand most of the time you're doing more strategic bombing. You're looking for a strategic target, like a bridge that ground troops could cross, or marshalling yards, things of that nature?
Yeah, mostly the points of interest. The missions were assigned by the headquarters based on requests most of the time from the ground troops, like Patton, his army would ask for certain things to be done, and we would be assigned a marshalling yard where the trains were gathered. We would be assigned to mostly railroad bridges. In fact, the nickname of our group was the Bridge Busters at one time, and that was the type of thing we did practically all the time.
And I mentioned the 12 missions, and that was what you're doing most of the time. And let's talk a little bit more about the B-26 in itself. You told us earlier about anti-aircraft fire and a shell actually going through your wing, and if it had exploded at the right time, you wouldn't be here talking to me. Anti-aircraft fire was pretty much an everyday occurrence if you flew a mission?
Probably 50 to 75%, somewhere in that neighborhood, were missions that we would call rough or hard. The milk runs were the rest of them, 25% or 30%, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the milk runs were the lovely ones, thank you.
But because of because of the B-26 and the firepower that you carried, at least that's your understanding, you didn't see a whole lot of fighter opposition from the Germans.
No. So we had a machine gun turret on the top of the aircraft. We had a tail gun turret, and we had fixed forward machine guns. We flew in tight formation. We flew in ship flight formations of six, very, very tight, and it was obvious that anyone that was attacking us was going to have a lot of 50 caliber machine gun fire coming their way. So we, at the time I was over there, we were never attacked by enemy fighters.
Well, and I know you're not complaining about that. No. And you mentioned the machine guns, and as I understand it, you didn't fire those machine guns, at least on your plane, until your last mission?
Yeah, we had four fixed forward machine guns on the side of the aircraft, and on the last mission, which was right near the end of the war, and what I called a demoralization mission, they were trying to get the Germans to forget the whole thing and give up, mm-hmm. and we went in and bombed at 5,000 feet, which was about half our normal altitude, and then made a 180 and came back and machine gunned the village. I didn't see any people. We were shooting at buildings, so I didn't have a guilty conscience over it. It was just kind of a, here we go, whoopee, we're going to fire our guns for the first time.
I imagine there was some joking about that on the aircraft.
That's huh? right.
You didn't know if they worked or not, probably.
Probably true.
So in the B-26, 12 missions, ever any time that the landing was a little hairy or you didn't know if you were going to make it down in one piece?
B-26 landings are always hairy.
Just by the nature
of it,
by
the nature, that's right. You're coming in at about 130, 120 miles an hour, and they were always hairy.
Jiggle your brain a little bit.
That's right.
Bridge busters and brain busters. But I understand your scariest situation as far as landing a plane, and maybe the one that you look back, besides the shell going through your wing and say, wow, that could have ended up a lot different for me. You weren't even in a B-26, but an aircraft that was a little smaller with a little less firepower. Tell me about that.
Yeah, while we were stationed near Paris, one of our B-26s had received a shot through an engine and knocked out the oil cooler. And I was assigned to take an oil cooler in a little L-5, a little fabric-covered cub. They were used mostly as observation planes. But I was to fly this up to Luxembourg. We stopped.
By yourself?
I had a fellow with me. Lieutenant Coons was with me. But I had charge of the mission on the way up. We stopped at Reims, got some fuel, and on the way to Luxembourg, ran into a headwind that we had not anticipated. And when I got very near Luxembourg, the gas gauge showed empty. So I landed in a little pasture somewhere outside of Luxembourg.
Now, you're making this sound very matter-of-fact.
Yeah, it was not too hard. You could land in a pasture. Anyway, there was an anti-aircraft battalion our side next to the field and next to the pasture. We got 5 gallons of gas from them, put it in the plane, and frankly, we flipped a coin to see who was going to take it off. And whether I won or lost, I don't know. But I was sitting in the back seat. Don was in the front. And we started down the pasture and came to a sudden stop at the end because there was a little ditch there that we didn't clear. The plane stopped immediately. I got hit on the back of the head and neck with the oil cooler that was on the shelf behind me and knocked unconscious for a short period of time. First thing I knew was Don says, the plane's on fire, let's get out of here. So the undercarriage had been knocked out, so we were sitting on the ground. I set the oil cooler out, got out, and we stood off and watched it burn.
Well, and I want to take you back, just rewind a minute here. When you're talking about putting it down in the pasture, you said, yeah, no big deal. But when you're up in that L5 and you've got a headwind, were you basically standing still? Is that what it felt like?
Oh, no, it wasn't that bad. No, it just the only reason that I say we had a headwind is because we didn't have enough fuel to make our destination.
Mm-hmm. And had you probably hadn't been in that situation before, right? I mean, you hadn't been in a lot of L5s, but...
Never, no, and I had never flown an L5 before, frankly.
Well, there's that, too. But so when you run out of gas and you're up in the air, you start looking for some place you can put it down.
That's the first thing you do in any training. Mm-hmm. From the time you start flying training in an airplane, you learn where you're going to land if something goes wrong. Primary flying school all the way through. Where am I going to put it down if the engine stops? So you're automatically thinking of that all the time.
And this was all friendly territory?
Yes. It had been already taken.
That helps. But how long did it take you to see this clearing? Were you looking at forest and forest and finally here's a clearing?
No,
or did you see it right
away? It was open land around there.
So that helps. That
yes,
makes you feel
yeah,
a little better.
It was not a problem.
I don't know if it was easy. I don't know if I'm buying you on that, but I'll take your word for it. So then you get knocked unconscious by this oil cooler, which was what you came there to bring to the B-26.
We did complete it. That we got it out and took it on into them.
And then how'd you get out of there?
Somebody took us into town in a truck. And then how I got back, I frankly can't remember whether somebody took us in a 6x6 back to Paris. And then right after we got back to Paris, we transferred into Belgium. So I was in one of those back of a 6x6 for a long time. And it bothered my head and neck that I so much that then I went into a hospital in Charleroi, Belgium, for a while.
So this was no fun for you. This
no,
wasn't
no,
good.
That
but
wasn't, that wasn't fun.
It sounds like it could have been a lot worse.
Could have been, sure. Anytime.
You were actually unconscious and woke up to find out you're on the inside of a burning plane.
Right.
And I'm amazed by how matter-of-fact this discussion is for you. I guess you've told the story a few times, but I don't know what I would do if I woke up in the middle of a burning plane.
You get out.
I guess so. And you completed your mission. You got that oil cooler
That's
to the
right.
B-26.
That's right.
That I'm sure you're very thankful for that. And I imagine you probably haven't stepped foot in an L-5 since then?
No, I've never been in that. However, I have flown light airplanes since then.
All right. So he's not worried about that anymore.
No.
And the war is still going on at this point. So you actually made it back to your unit?
Oh, yeah. This was in March of 44. 5 that that occurred. And May 8th was our VE day.
Exactly.
When the thing was finished over there.
Well, and I know you have many more memories from the war. I want to talk about some more of those and some of the things that you witnessed. One of the things that I enjoy about this show is just getting the vivid descriptions of what veterans saw, whether it was something they were necessarily involved in a combat role or not, but painting some of those pictures that I think it's so easy to forget about here today in our world. Bob Stoneham of Mariposa is our guest. We're going to come back with some more of his stories. Talk a little bit about what's happened since 1945. You're listening to Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
From the late, great Glenn Miller and his orchestra, String of Pearls. And believe it or not, our guest today, Bob Stoneham, has a little story to tell about that as well. And we're going to have a footnote to that story about his hairy landing in an L5 in Luxembourg, and I guess a hairier takeoff that he described. But let's talk about this, Bob. Glenn Miller and his orchestra, as a young serviceman overseas, you thought you were going to get a chance to see them perform in France, right?
Absolutely. It was the 15th of December. I was on leave in Paris. Down on the Champs-Élysées, and we went into the theater, and the Glenn Miller Band was there. The announcer opened with a statement that we would go ahead with the band program, but Glenn wasn't there yet. He was on his way over from England, and that was the day he was lost.
Wow. And that's, you know, such a famous story that everyone who's ever talked about Glenn Miller knows that his plane went down somewhere.
Somewhere. They never know. Never have found it. Never found any trace of it.
And I bet it was a while before you found out that that was the day he died, right?
That's right. Yeah.
But you went back and put that together. Oh, that's why he never showed up. Well, that's certainly an interesting footnote in history there. And speaking of history, you know, you've had these experiences in your brain for decades, for more than 60 years. But I understand just a couple years ago, you got a phone call out of the blue that took you back to that experience you just shared with us about landing and taking off in that L5.
That was interesting. A telephone call from Luxembourg. It was a captain in the Luxembourg Army saying that he had done some work in the Patton Museum and knew about my crash landing and wondered if I would send him some information on it. He had more information than I did. He had the actual accident report that was there in their archives at the Patton Museum in Luxembourg. But it was an interesting back and forth with him a couple of times.
I imagine that when you get a phone call like that, it gets your attention. You're so used to the telemarketers and somebody wanting this and that, and then they say that. You say, hello.
Hello. I'm from Luxembourg.
That is something else. Were you able to learn anything from that accident report that maybe you didn't remember?
No.
Just the basics.
Just the basics.
But somebody was thinking about you and wondering what happened, and they found that crash. And that's, you know, something that we don't think about that often. There are still plenty of those sites waiting to be discovered where planes went down. There are still pilots missing from World War II.
Yeah, probably true.
And Glenn Miller, as you just brought up. So that was an interesting little small world connection there. And you've had a chance to go back to Europe to see some of the areas that you went through in the war. I want to ask you about one area in particular. When you were there, not necessarily in the air, but on the ground being transported, you went through the city of Cologne. After it had been bombed?
We were on the highway right across the river from Cologne, and we could see the city plain, but there was nothing there except the cathedral. The rest of the city looked like it had all been flattened.
And I imagine that has to have kind of a, even though that's the enemy, you know, there's a visceral effect there, isn't there?
You know, when you say the enemy you know, that's an interesting thing to talk about, because since then, in our church that we go to in Oakhurst, mm-hmm. is a very, very dear friend that was in the German army shooting at me the time I was there. And those people were really, the people were not our enemies.
That's right.
It was the
That's
thing right. that was going on. But as I say, this very dear friend Herman is still one of my closest friends, and he says when he looks up, he imagines a bomb coming down from me, and I look down and imagine him shooting up at him.
Well, now, and you say that, and that was my question, because you could say he was down there shooting at me because you were on the Allied side and he was on the German side. But were you actually in the same location at the same time?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I don't know.
And I mean, it doesn't take anything away from it, but that would be even more amazing.
Yeah, it's fun
for you to meet up that way. I think you hit on a very important point too, and that's what I was kind of going for with that question. When you see that kind of devastation, it doesn't matter who's on what side. That just kind of makes you hurt, doesn't it?
That's correct. And after the war, our group went into Munich, the Army of Occupation, and as we drove into the city, it was almost impossible to believe the destruction that had happened to that city. The bricks were all in the street.
Well, and I know so many veterans like you have told me that, you know, you did what you did because your country asked you to do it, and it was in the hope that nothing like this would ever have to be done again in world history. And you've been back there to see, right, how some of these cities have been built back up?
That's right. We've been fortunate enough to visit all of them.
What did that mean to you to see that it had recovered and that there was a rebound there, that wasn't what you saw back in 1945 wasn't the final end result?
Gosh, you've got me. I don't know that I could stop and answer that. It's amazing to see what they did. That's all I can say.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we could spend a whole nother hour talking about all the complexities that are tied into that. But there's a lot of hidden stories in that brain of yours there, Bob. And I can tell, and you've dropped a few of them on me. I'm always fascinated by the relations that develop between American veterans, and whether it's from the Japanese side or the German side or whoever, when you see those friendships. And then you realize this really is a human story. It's not about a gun or a plane or a bomb. It's a human story, and you've definitely brought that to us today. And your human story, another thing I like to do with this show is see. Now, I wouldn't be here if my grandfather didn't come home from World War II. And you have two children, six grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren.
Correct.
Who wouldn't be here if you hadn't got out of that burning plane in Luxembourg. But you also never would have met your wife, Betty, of 63 years if you hadn't made it home. So tell me about that. You come home from the war. What are you thinking that you're going to be up to once you get back to California?
You know, I really hadn't the faintest idea.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was going to finish school. The training that I'd gotten in the service, the college training detachment and so on, had given me enough credits that with the end of the semester of at 45 that I would graduate from 46, I should say, would graduate from junior college. It had no idea what I was going to do. After I'd met this girl in March or so of 46, I went with my father one day, who was in the real estate business in Modesto, into a title company.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager of the title company said, "Would you be interested in a job?" Bingo. Here's something that's come open. And I said, "Yes, I might." And so the president of Security Title was coming in the next day. He says, "Come in and talk to him." And I was hired to go to work on July 1st of 46 in the title company.
And 63 years later, you're still doing it, right?
No, I retired. I'm retired now.
But it's still in the family,
yeah,
which is important to you, I know. And so now you and Betty had gone to grade school together, but you just happened to meet her on a bus one day after you got back?
Went on a bus trip up to Sacramento to a basketball game. Fateful trip. And this cute girl was with a bunch of other girls. And when we got to the basketball game in Sacramento, I was able to get a seat next to her. And it has been improving since then.
63 years later, still improving every day, right? And you didn't even have to show her your hot pilot picture to get her to.
No, I don't know what attracted her. I have no idea, and I'm kind of afraid to ask her.
All right, well, I won't put her on the spot and ask her either. But you two look so very happy. How old are you now, Bob?
I'm only 85.
Ask. Only 85.
Yeah.
And has the youth and enthusiasm of someone half that age. And I think you at home can hear that as you hear him talk to me.
You know, one of the things that I should mention that I'm so proud of, I was in a war that we won.
Mm-hmm.
Stop and think.
That's...
We haven't won a war since then.
Well, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because I was about to ask you, not just what you're most proud of, but and I I can tell you're a guy who thinks about a lot of things. You're a very thoughtful person, and you've thought about what you've done in the war and what the significance was. You think about your grandkids and great-grandkids, and they only get a chapter in a textbook here, or maybe they see a movie that tells part of the story, if it even gets it right. But if you had a chance to sit them down and say, this is what World War II was about, this is what we were fighting for, this is why you need to know about it. I know this is a tough question, but how would you put that in a nutshell? What would you say is the most important thing for our future generations of Americans to understand about your generation and what you did?
Well, firstly, you've got to remember that the reason that I got involved was because my country was attacked.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we really, other than the terrorist thing that's going on now, and you don't know whether you call that an attack, I guess you have to call it an attack.
Mm-hmm.
But the war since then that we've been involved in, we were never attacked. We were going in to do something for somebody. In my opinion, in Vietnam, we should never have been there. Mm-hmm. Had no business there. And some of the others, I'm not sure. And Russia got messed up entirely in Afghanistan. I don't know why we're here. There. But those are things that come to mind when I think of what we did in our war, which is completely different.
Well, yeah, you were attacked on December 7, 1941. And the entire country, I think, really believed that freedom was in question here. And not eventually not just the freedom of the United States, but all of those countries in Europe that were being persecuted as well.
That's right.
So there wasn't really any question in your mind whether this was worthwhile or not, or you didn't hesitate to do what you did.
No, and we don't want to talk politics today either.
No, we sure don't. We sure don't. When you think about the guys that you served with, what kind of characteristics did you appreciate in them? When you think back and you think about the kind of people that Americans were at that time, and servicemen and the pilots and crew members in the U.S. Army Air Corps, what did you most appreciate about them?
Everybody was dedicated in doing the job the best way they could. We had a job to do. We wanted to do it, finish it up, and come home. Everyone, the people at home, my oldest brother helped in the shipyards in the Bay Area building Victory ships. And the brother next older than I was in the Navy in the South Pacific. We just wanted to get the job done and come home.
And y'all did?
We all did.
I think somebody back home must have been praying or something.
Right.
How do you ever think about that? And I just brought it up, the fact that you never would have met Betty. You wouldn't have your two children or six grandchildren or six great-grandchildren if you didn't come back. You ever think back and reflect on those close calls you had and wonder, could that have really been me? And why did I survive when someone else maybe did not?
That's another subject we're not going to get into. I presented a little program at our church one day, Why Am I Here?
Mm-hmm.
And I just rather not get in it because we get very religious then, and I don't want to do that.
I'm not trying to stop you from that. We've got a couple minutes left.
You wonder why you're here. Why am I still here?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason?
Mm-hmm.
Does God have some reason for going through these things and getting here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I think you do know. And that's what I get from you, that you feel like God had a plan for you.
That's exactly right.
And it's kind of hard to argue with that when you look back at all the facts. Is there one thing, Bob, that you personally are most proud to have taken part in a particular mission or grander scheme of things kind of idea in the war in Europe that you look back on and that just really makes you feel good to have had a hand in it?
Mm. You didn't say you were going to be tough questions. I thought they were all going to be easy when I came in here.
Well, you've passed the ball with flying colors, so I'm up in the ante on you.
The probably one thing that sticks in my mind is when we went into Munich in Army of Occupation, some of the guys from our group went to Dachau, mm-hmm. and they saw what had happened there,
mm-hmm.
and they told about it. And frankly, I'm glad that I didn't go, but that's one of the reasons that we were there, and that's one of the reasons that we were successful is because we were dedicated in doing the job, finishing that thing up, and the things that were going on over there were just things that you don't want to talk about.
Well, and I hear you, and you know, people say, well, sometimes they'll say if the Americans had gotten involved in the war sooner, they could have saved some of these lives or whatever. You know, there's no way of taking away the lives that were cost with the German atrocities, But there were lives that were saved by the liberations of those camps. And every one of those survivors is extremely thankful that it happened when it did. And I so admire the foresight of General Eisenhower to say, make sure this all gets documented right, so people know about it. So you're saying you're glad you weren't there personally, but you're glad that they did document those atrocities. Well, Bob, it's been a great pleasure spending some time with you this morning and this afternoon here in Fresno, and greatly appreciate your willingness to share some of those stories. Thank you so much for serving our country, and I guess you're probably not flying a B-26 anytime soon?
No, I'm not flying a B-26, and I appreciate your having me in, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you. There is one B-26 still flying, still operational.
Down in Florida, I think. No, there's one in Southern California, too. I think there's two of them.
There's two of them. Maybe okay, two. I correct myself. As long as the one in Florida doesn't go in Tampa Bay, we're okay. Well, that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. Bob Stone of Mariposa has been our guest. Remember, you can listen online to all of our past programs at kmjnow.com. Thanks for listening today on News Talk 580 KMJ.